WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville.
On my good horse I call you, my shiny black bears, to the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding,
what were those people cheering for? Was it the latest pop star or TV contest idol? No, those people were cheering for a 75-year-old professor who was about to give a speech on the recycled rhetoric of the war on terrorism and how it is portrayed, misportrayed, or not portrayed in the U.S. corporate media, the very media that routinely claims that it gives the people what we want. So how come a man who speaks to tens of thousands of cheering people each year and is interviewed regularly in media outside the United States, whose books are bestsellers in spite of the fact that they have no promotion, never appears in America's major media outlets? The objective of the American corporate media is not necessarily to give you what you want, but to give you what they want, which is programming that will attract as many potential buyers for their advertisers' products as possible, and who will be receptive to the ads after having been put in a state of mind and kept in a state of ignorance by what they have been shown or not shown. Feeling worried, scared, lonely, empty, trapped? Be entertained. Buy our products. Don't worry, be happy. Global warming? What global warming? Body bags and dead babies? Not on our TV screens. Have a mad cow burger with pesticide fries. Oh, too fat? Well, we have diet products for you, too. Well, toss out the mad cow burger. For the next 2 hours, I'd like to offer you some serious brain food from three radical scientists talking about propaganda, indoctrination, how it works, and how not to let it suck you in. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary.
Some of you know our next speaker. He's chronicled for all of us for decades the massive crimes carried out covertly and overtly by the empire makers, by the war makers and the profiteers. He's helped us to dissect and analyze the lying corporate media that keep us in the chains of ignorance. And he's helped us, along with other writers and other activists and intellectuals, to break those chains. It is my very, very great honor and privilege to introduce to you, the people of Vancouver, Dr. Noam Chomsky.
After that nice introduction, I can't avoid opening by quoting from the lying corporate media, which I got a clip from. I don't know how many tens of thousands of talks I've given over the last 40 years, but I've learned that when I don't have time to prepare a talk, the easiest way to arrange it is just to read the morning's newspapers. And that almost invariably, it never fails. There's always something there that you can talk about. So this morning's no exception. Jack just introduced me without thinking about it. This is the Globe and Mail. I didn't hear Bush this morning, but I did read his talk from yesterday. And it's interesting and worth thinking about. And the report is interesting. Begins by saying that George Bush called the broader war on terror the inescapable calling of our generation, warning that human civilization itself is at stake. Okay. Now, he doesn't remember because he was probably drunk at a frat party at Yale at the time. But the people around him and his speechwriters and handlers remember very well that they wrote the same words for his colleagues over 20 years ago, back in 1981, when they came into office, pretty much the same people, and immediately opened by declaring a war on terror, which was, their words, the plague of the modern age, a war against civilization itself. Which we had to battle relentlessly. And they fought that war on terror for the first 12 years they were in office, and they've picked it up again. And if we want to have any idea what they're doing, we should have a look at the 12 years in which they waged the war on terror. It was a real one. Our friend from the FMLN can tell us about it. They were one of the prime targets of the war on terror. Actually, that his talk reminded me of a painting I have in my office, given to me by a Jesuit priest who painted it. It's a painting of the angel of death holding a scythe. And below him is a portrait of Archbishop Romero. His assassination opened that great decade. Alongside of him are the six Jesuit intellectuals who were murdered, had their brains blown out, ending the decade of the war on terror, and their housekeeper and her daughter who were caught in the crossfire. That frames the decade on terror pretty well. And there's a side comment to make about it. I've had it for years. And I've noticed that everyone who comes into my office, everyone from south of the Rio Grande who comes into my office knows exactly what it is. And virtually no one from the United States, or I'm sorry to say Canada, knows what it is. We don't pay attention to our own crimes. We don't count them up. They don't exist. That's a war against terror. And El Salvador was only one target. They only had about 70,000 people slaughtered in the war on terror. The rest of Central America added up to who knows. Since we don't count, we don't know. Maybe 200,000. And they're real achievements. Somebody has a sign there saying Bush is the real terrorist. Well, actually, he's a convicted terrorist. He and his accomplices. It's the only government in history that has been condemned by the World Court for international terrorism, namely the attack against the war on against Nicaragua. Would have been condemned by the Security Council, except that the U.S. vetoed two resolutions, with Britain kindly abstaining, condemned repeatedly by the General Assembly. But it doesn't matter. Because it's air crimes, so it's not terrorism. And Central America is only one of the places where they waged the war on terror. They also waged it, for example, in Southern Africa. During the Reagan years, there was a policy called constructive engagement with Southern Africa, the Southeast African apartheid regime. during just those years, constructive engagement, the South African regime killed about 1.5 million people and caused about $60 billion of damage in the surrounding countries alone. Forget what was happening in South Africa. Well, the moderate, who is now the Secretary of State, he comes out of central casting as a moderate, was the National Security Advisor toward the end when the worst atrocities were being carried out. And the Pentagon in 1988 declared Nelson Mandela's African National Congress to be one of the more notorious terrorist groups in the world. This was at the time when the Reagan administration, the guys now in office, were finding ways to circumvent the congressional sanctions against aid and trade with South Africa, which they were able to increase, while the press, what was it, corporate lying press, since I'm quoting it, I don't have to take responsibility for it, they quietly managed not to see what was happening. And the same was going on in the Middle East. The same was going on in Southeast Asia with Canada's very strong support during the near genocide in East Timor. And we can go on. That was the first war on terror, the war to save civilization from the plague of terror, assault by barbarians who are about to destroy civilization. So there's really nothing new is going on. The speechwriters can just plagiarize. In fact, it's the same words. Can't hear me? Oh, okay. Sorry. If you can't hear me, you can join my wife. She always complains. She always complains that I'm mumbling. She can't hear me. Actually, she actually went to a doctor who pays attention to your ears. I forget. To find out if she was losing her hearing, and he gave her a hearing test, and he asked her why she thought so, and she said she could never hear her husband, and he gave her the test, and she said, "Well, your husband's mumbling, just like this." So sorry if you can't hear me. The war on terror is very much like this one in other respects, many other respects, not just what's happening in Iraq, and it's worth paying attention to it, you know. We're not supposed to pay attention to what we've done in the past for good reasons. You learn too much. But we don't have to follow those rules. It's what schools are for, and journals and so on, but we don't have to follow them. The first war on terror began in 1981, and you'll remember there was another brave cowboy. He was hiding in the White House, surrounded by tanks in 1981 to protect him from the Libyan hitmen who were roaming the streets of Washington trying to assassinate our leader. Luckily, he managed to escape. You're making me feel like I'm in my living room or my wife can't hear me. I'm up to 1983 when the United States was seriously threatened, much worse than Saddam Hussein. There was in Grenada, the nutmeg capital of the world, there was an airbase being built from which, by the British, but didn't matter, from which the Russians might bomb us. And that's a serious threat. Most Americans probably thought Grenada was in Africa somewhere, but in fact it's pretty close. But fortunately, the cowboy sent 6,000 special forces who overcame the resistance of a couple of dozen construction workers, killed 40 or 50 of one another in the process, and got 8,000 medals of honor. And we were standing tall, as the president said, saved by the courage of the cowboy. A year later, a national emergency was declared in the United States with words that should be familiar from last year. In fact, the wording of the declaration of the national emergency was approximately the same as the wording of the congressional authorization for the war in Iraq. Almost the same. Reagan declared a national emergency because of the unusual and extraordinary threat to the security of the United States posed by the government of Nicaragua. which was 2 days' driving time from Texas. And as the Secretary of the State said, they were waving their copies of Mein Kampf as they were coming to conquer us. But somehow we escaped that one, too. Then came others, including domestic ones. George Bush, number one, was elected in 1988 on a race card, straight. He's going to save your sister from being raped by black criminals, Willie Horton, if you remember. That was, you got to be afraid of that one. There's nothing new going on. This is just a repetition of a very familiar formula. If you're shafting people, and they were shafting the population, they suffered badly in those years, you got to frighten them. There's no other known way to keep population under control. And it's happening now. It's happening now. This article goes on to describe, and that's an interesting one. He's criticizing Spain, and the article reads, it's a warning to Spain where leaders have threatened to withdraw their troops from Iraq. That's the conventional falsification, and a very interesting one. The Spanish Prime Minister didn't threaten to withdraw his troops from Iraq. He threatened to withdraw his troops from U.S. command in Iraq. That's quite a difference, and a crucial difference. In fact, what the press should be reporting is that the Spanish people took exactly the same position as the vast majority of the people of the United States, who as far back as last April were saying U.S. ought to get out. This is whatever happened for it or against it. This should be under the administration of the United Nations until you can turn it over to the people of Iraq. Well, that's what the people of Spain voted for the other day. So there's unity between the people of Spain and the people of the United States, but you're not going to find it described in the lying corporate media. We're not supposed to know that. We're not supposed to know that, but we should. It's important. And that's what the war is about right now. I mean, you can think whatever you like about what happened, but the issue now, and since the bombs start falling, is who is going to rule Iraq? And with all the vacillations of policy of the United States and before them Britain and Canada quietly in the background, with all the vacillations of policy, that's been the issue for over 80 years. Britain created Iraq. It was just, you know, it wasn't a country. They drew the boundaries so that they could get the oil of the north and not the Turks, and so that the new country would be under their control because it wouldn't have access to the sea. That's why Kuwait was put in there, the Principality of Kuwait, to block access to the sea so the new country would be a client. Actually, what they called it was an independent state. It had a parliament and a constitution and all sorts of nice things. But the British said it's an Arab facade that the British rule behind various constitutional fictions. That was in secret. But the Iraqis certainly knew about it. In the case of Kuwait, the British refused to give it even nominal sovereignty until it looked like it was going to get out of control in 1958, at which point they said, okay, it can have its own post office. But secretly, Britain and the United States agreed that the British would have the right, in their words, ruthlessly to intervene if anything got out of control, internally or anywhere else. And the U.S. reserved the same right to ruthlessly intervene in the bigger countries, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates. U.S. takes the big ones, Britain's allowed the little one. That's the way the game works. Canada picks up some contracts on the side. I won't run through the whole story, but it continues without a change. In 1975, the United States and Britain strongly supported the Iraqi government when it massacred Kurds, huge massacre of Kurds. Henry Kissinger was asked about this in congressional testimony. And he said, yeah, we did it, but you have to understand that foreign policy shouldn't be confused with missionary work. You've got to admire Kissinger for his honesty. He's usually quite straightforward. As soon as Saddam Hussein came in, Britain and the United States, of course, immediately supported him. In 1982, the U.S. took Iraq off the terrorist list, had been on the terrorist list. It was taken off in 1982 so that the U.S. could provide him freely with arms, badly needed agricultural aid, dual-use technology to produce weapons of mass destruction, and continue to support him right through the worst atrocities. Now you hear Bush and Blair and Rice and other hypocrites talking about the terrible atrocities and the mass graves and so on and so forth. Yeah, they knew all about it, and they continued to support him. It had nothing to do with the war in Iran. It continued without a change after that war was over. They continued to support him because it didn't matter. He was a valued ally and was good for U.S. Business, as they pointed out. So, yeah, we'll continue to support him while he gasses Kurds and tortures dissidents and does anything he'd like. In 1982, when he was taken off the terrorist list, they had an empty spot, so they had to put someone in. So they put Cuba in. Cuba was put in as a terrorist state, I presume, in response to the fact that there had just been a sharp escalation in the wave of U.S.-backed terror against Cuba that's been going on since 1959. It had peaked in the late 70s, shooting down airliners, ships, bombing embassies, and so on. So, yeah, Cuba had to be put on the terrorist list once Saddam was removed, still there. In 1991, that was a crucial time. In 1991, Saddam probably would have been overthrown. There was a rebellion in the south. Probably would have overthrown him. The U.S. was in total control of the area. It was after the war. They basically authorized Saddam to crush the uprising. And furthermore, they explained why. You don't have to go to secret documents. You can read it in the New York Times. The New York Times explained that it was right to support Saddam to crush the uprising because Saddam offered more hope for stability in the region than the people who were trying to overthrow him. Thomas Friedman, whose rantings you can still read, explained that, as he put it, the best of all worlds for the United States would be an iron-fisted military junta which would rule Iraq the same way Saddam did, but not with his name. He was a little embarrassing by then. But since we can't get the best of all worlds, we'll have to do with the second best, namely Saddam himself. That was 1991. Then comes 10 years of sanctions, which we're not supposed to think about. The reason we're not supposed to think about them is that they, by the most conservative measures, they killed hundreds of thousands of Iraqis, devastated the society, strengthened the tyrant, compelled the population to rely on him for survival. Otherwise, he probably would have been overthrown a long time ago by the population of Iraq. It would have gone the same way as the list of other gangsters that the same people supported. That's quite a rogues gallery, like Suharto. You know all about that. Canada helped support him. He was ranked easily with Saddam Hussein, overthrown from within. Ceausescu, as grotesque as you can get, supported to the last minute by the people now in Washington, Bush 1 administration, overthrown from within. Marcos, Duvalier, Mobutu, quite a long list, and in fact new names are constantly being added. Overthrown from within, not Saddam. Why? Because the society was devastated. You had to rely on him just for mere survival. But the same principle, Iraq can't be run by Iraqis. And so it continues at this moment. The people of Iraq are, I'm not talking about the bombers, I'm talking about the general population, are steadfastly refusing to be returned to the colonial status that the current imperial overlord is preparing for them. And it's quite a struggle. And the important thing for us is that it's a struggle that we can determine the outcome. It's outrageous to leave it to the people of Iraq to fight this battle. I mean, we can applaud them for doing it and praise them for their courage, but we should look in the mirror and not praise what we see. We should be stopping it. There's no reason why we can't prevent... why we can't prevent the crime that is being carried out. And it's not in the front pages. You know, it's not a matter of bombing a hotel and this and that and the other thing. It's just this systematic refusal to accept the orders that are being imposed by the proconsul, Paul Bremer of the Pentagon, to try to prevent a democratic evolution in which the people of Iraq will take control of their own country. Some of the most extreme and grotesque measures are actually just economic. The orders which forcefully open the Iraqi economy up to foreign takeover by U.S., Canadian, British multinationals. I mean, that undermines any hope for authentic democracy and sovereignty and also for economic development. Well, we don't have to sit here and watch that. You know, those orders are coming from our governments. We can stop them. And it goes down the list. I'll just end by saying, as you all know, this is the second of the huge mass demonstrations against the war, now the occupation in Iraq. The first one was immediately before the war. It was unprecedented. There had never been anything like it in the whole history of European imperialism, hundreds of years. Europe, I include the United States and Canada. There had never been a protest, anything like it. This is the first time there had ever been mass popular protest against a war before it was launched. Just to see how far we've come in, say, 40 years. Remember the Vietnam War. The Vietnam War was launched in 1962. That's when John F. Kennedy sent the U.S. Air Force to attack South Vietnam. That's when he started the programs which drove millions of people into concentration camps. That's when he started chemical warfare to destroy crops and to clear the ground for counterinsurgency operations. According to the Vietnamese, there are 600,000 victims of that. We don't pay any attention to it. We don't count our victims as usual. That was 1962. Was there any protest? I mean, those of you who are old enough will remember. There was so little protest that the event is out of history. I mean, it's literally out of history. Nobody knows it happened because nobody cared. We want to attack and destroy another country? That's fine. It took years before any protest developed. 5 or 6 years later, you started getting protests. By that time, South Vietnam, which was always the main target of the attack, had been virtually destroyed. And then you started getting protests, and it was important. But it was mostly about the peripheral issues, if you think back. It was mostly about the bombing of the North. Well, the bombing of the North was a serious problem, but it was nothing like the bombing of South Vietnam. In fact, it was radically different. The bombing of the North was modulated and planned and careful, because it was costly to the United States. When you bombed North Vietnam, you were bombing an internal Chinese railroad. They were bombing Russian ships in the Haiphong Harbor, embassies in Hanoi. You know, somebody might get mad. When you're bombing South Vietnam, no objection at all, because they can't resist. They can't do anything. So therefore, they were practically destroyed. To the end, virtually no protest. Now, 40 years later, there's massive protest against wars before they start. And that's really important. Don't think that the planners are unaware of it. You may not study it in school, but they're aware of it. By 1968... after the Tet Offensive, Lyndon Johnson wanted to send 200,000 more troops to South Vietnam. The Pentagon refused. And we know why from the internal documents. They refused because they were afraid that if they sent more troops to South Vietnam, there would be a civil uprising in the United States. They would need them for what they called civil disorder control in the United States, from young people, from women, from minorities, from working people. They just didn't want to send them, and they didn't. When George Bush number one came in, he did whatever every president does. He called for an intelligence analysis of the world situation. A piece of this was leaked, which is very unusual. We never learn about them. But a piece was leaked. Somebody in the Pentagon probably didn't like it. And it was important. What was leaked was a discussion of military intervention. It said that in the case of wars against much weaker enemies, which is, of course, the only kind you'd ever dream of fighting if you have any brains. But in the case of wars against much weaker enemies, the U.S. must win rapidly and decisively because otherwise political support will collapse because it's too thin. It's not like the 60s where you can go on for year after year and nobody gives a damn. That's a change, and it's part of a general change. It's part of a civilizing development throughout the whole society, in fact, much of the world. And it's the result of mass demonstrations, but important as they are, they're only a small part of it. They're important because they inspire people to go on and do what really matters, the day-to-day work of organizing, educating, picking up the right local activities, whatever they may be. And ultimately, that does lead to changes. And it'll continue to. We should be looking ahead. It's just to think what's been... Nobody assumed that the huge demonstrations last year were going to stop the war. Mass actions are really important, but a few of them aren't going to stop a juggernaut. They can throw a wrench in the works. They can slow it down, but they're not going to stop it. If they continue, they can. They can stop it, they can reverse it, and they can dismantle it. It simply has to continue. The guys who run the show have a phrase, complicated phrase, called anticipatory self-defense, which is the new legalism, which means unprovoked aggression without pretext, as long as you can get away with it, as long as it's a much weaker enemy. That's called anticipatory self-defense. Well, you know, we ought to be thinking of that too. We have to anticipate what's coming next, not wait for it. And we have to be engaged in self-defense. But defense of the kind of values that a decent person could uphold with pride. That means defense of justice and freedom, not of violence and domination.
That was MIT linguistics professor Noam Chomsky speaking last week in Vancouver, Canada, on the eve of the global protest against war and occupation. Thanks to Red Eye Cooperative Radio for that recording.
My portfolio is high. I'm going on vacation. Anywhere I wanna, I put it on my card. I could use a little sun and to see some ancient ruins. The pyramids are calling, off to Egypt I will fly. I go swimming in the big Egyptian river, bathing in the waters of the Nile. The sun is shining down and everybody's happy, bathing in the waters of the Nile. My job is so secure and my government is stable. The weather's getting better a little warmer every year. And now we've got free trade, and everyone will prosper. The locals here are happy, I think I'll have another beer. Let's go swimming now, we're swimming in the big Egyptian river. Bathing in the waters of the Nile. The sun is shining down and everybody's happy. Bathing in the waters of the Nile. I thought I heard a bomb, it must be a celebration. If anything was wrong, they tell me on TV. Sometimes I am amazed how perfect things are going. I think I'll do some shopping and take a little time for me. Everybody's doing it, we're swimming in the big Egyptian river.
Backstroke, breaststroke, sidestroke, crawl.
Bathing in the waters of the Nile.
He's got it, he's got it all.
The sun's shining down and everybody's happy.
Happy, he's so happy, happy.
Bathing in the waters.
The talk by Harvard biologist Richard Lewontin that you're about to hear was the first of a series of lectures he gave at the University of Toronto in 1990 on the theme Biology as Ideology. It could have been given yesterday, it's so relevant. Richard Lewontin is the Alexander Agassiz Professor of Zoology at Harvard and is renowned in his field for his studies of population genetics. He's authored many books, both popular and technical, on evolutionary biology and genetics, as well as the philosophy of science. He's been an outspoken critic and activist against militarism and class privilege since the 1960s, and as an advocate of making science answerable to the majority of the people rather than in the service of an elite.
I want to talk tonight, and in the four lectures that follow this one, about a social institution about which there's a great deal of misunderstanding, even among those who are part of it. That institution is science. Most of what I want to say will be specifically about biology, but biology is only a model of how science works in general. We think of science as an institution, as a set of methods, a set of people, a great body of knowledge that we call scientific knowledge. And we see it as somehow being pretty much apart from the forces that rule our everyday lives and that govern the structure of our society. Science is objective. And of course, science has brought us all kinds of good things. It has tremendously increased the production of food. It's increased our life expectancy from a mere 45 years at the beginning of the century to over 70 in rich countries like ours. It's put people on the moon, and it's made it possible to sit at home and watch the world go by. Of course, it's produced some horrors, too, like the nuclear bomb and pesticides that pollute our environment. But we believe that science just uncovers the facts, and it's society that either uses or misuses them for good or evil. What I want to say about science in these lectures is quite different. I want to try to convince you that science, like any other productive activity, like the state, like the family, like sport, is a social institution. And as such, it's completely integrated into and influenced by the rest of our social institutions. The problems that science deals with, the ideas that it uses in investigating those problems, even the so-called scientific results that come out of scientific investigation, are really all deeply influenced by predispositions that derive from the society in which we live. Scientists do not begin life, after all, as scientists. They begin as social beings, like everyone else, immersed in a family, a state, a productive structure, and they view nature through a lens that's been molded by their social experience. What else could they do? But even above that personal level of perception, science is molded by society because it's a human productive activity. It takes time, it takes money. Science uses commodities, and it produces commodities that are sold in the marketplace. People earn their living by it. I earn my living by it. And as a consequence, the dominant social and economic forces in society that control time and money determine to a large extent what science does and how it does it. But more than that, those people with access to power are able to appropriate from science ideas that are particularly suited to the maintenance and continued prosperity of existing social structures. I'm going to give many examples in my talks, but let me begin with one that's particularly prominent at the present. For some years now, women have been pressing a society dominated by men to give up that domination and to open all the avenues of power and control of their own lives to women. In an effort to legitimize the differential power of men in society, educational institutions controlled by men, like the one in which I work, and newspapers, magazines, radio, and TV that regularly report and popularize the claims of intellectuals, have been producing all sorts of claims for the biological inferiority of women. It's instructive to see how one scientific claim follows another, as different aspects of women's biology are said to be important. Sometimes it's claimed that women's bodies are simply too slight to carry out the heavy physical work of being, say, an electrician or a firefighter. Then it's said that women's hormones make them unreliable on a monthly basis. You wouldn't want a menstruating woman flying an airplane, would you? Most recently, we've heard that the structure of women's brains make them worse at mathematics and other serious cognitive work, although they're fine at intuition, because they use the left halves of their brains, whereas men use the right cognitive halves. Finally, we've been told that women use both halves of their brains more than men do, so that women can't think about specialized things. Of course, all of these differences are said to be coded in our genes. So women do not have the genes for math, the genes for business, the genes for aggressiveness, the genes for all those things that are supposed to give power in society. Women are doomed by their genes to an inferior position. And no matter how well-intentioned we may be, we just have to face facts. Anatomy is destiny. So social institutions have an input into science, both in what's done and how it's thought about. And they take from science concepts and ideas which then support those institutions and make them seem legitimate and natural. It's this dual process that is meant when I say science is an ideology. Look, science serves two functions. First, it provides us with new ways of manipulating the material world. It produces a set of techniques, practices, inventions by which new things are produced and by which the quality of our lives is changed. These are the aspects of science to which scientists appeal when they try to get money from governments or when they appear on the front pages of newspapers in their public relations pressures to support their continued prosperity. We read repeatedly about how science has discovered something. But more often than not, these announcements are hedged around with all sorts of qualifiers. Biologists discover evidence for genes that may one day lead to a possible cure for cancer. While their over-optimistic reports breed a certain cynicism, it's nevertheless true that scientists do actually change the way in which we confront the material world. The second function of science, which is sometimes independent and sometimes closely related to the first, is the function of explanation. Even if scientists are not actually changing the material mode of our existence, they're constantly explaining why things are the way they are. They're producing theories about the world. It's often said that those theories must be produced in order, ultimately, to change the world through practice. After all, how can we cure cancer unless we understand what causes cancer? How can we increase our food production unless we understand the laws of genetics and plant and animal nutrition? Yet it's remarkable how much really important practical science has been quite independent of theory. In a later talk, I'm going to consider one of the most famous examples of scientific agricultural change, the introduction of hybrid corn all over the world. Hybrid corn is claimed to be one of the great triumphs of modern genetics in action, in helping to feed people and increase their well-being. Yet, as a matter of fact, the development of hybrid corn, and indeed almost all of plant and animal breeding, as it's actually practiced, has been carried out in a way that's completely independent of any scientific theory about how it ought to work. Indeed, a great deal of plant and animal breeding has been done in a way indistinguishable from the methods of past centuries before anyone had ever heard of genetics. The same is true for our attempts to cope with killers, like cancer and heart disease. Most cures for cancer are either the surgical removal of the growing tumor or its destruction with powerful radiations or chemicals. Virtually none of this progress in cancer therapy has occurred through a deep understanding of the elementary processes of cell growth and development. Although nearly all of the cancer research, above the purely clinical level, is devoted precisely to that understanding. So, despite all the talk of scientific medicine, medicine remains essentially an empirical process in which people do what works. If we look at the actual accomplishments of science, it's not at all clear that a correct understanding of how the world works is basic to many successful manipulations of the world. But explanations of how the world really works serve another purpose, one in which has been a remarkable success, irrespective of the practical truth of scientific claims. That purpose is legitimating society as we know it. Irrespective of what your political view may be, everyone has to agree that we live in a world in which psychic and material welfare is very unevenly distributed. There are rich people and poor people. There are sick people and healthy people. People who have control over the conditions of their own lives, like professors who give lectures on the radio, and those who have their tasks assigned to them, who are overseen, who have little or no control over any psychic or material aspects of their own lives, like the janitor who's going to come in and sweep up the studio when we're finished here. There are rich countries and poor countries. Some races dominate others. Men and women have very unequal social and material power. Some kind of inequality of status, wealth, health, and power have been characteristic of every society about which we know. That means that in every society about which we know, there's some form of struggle going on between those who have and those who have not, between those with social power and those who are deprived of it. The uprisings of blacks in American cities in the 1960s and 1970s, in which there was a vast destruction of property and what you might call a radical redistribution of consumer goods, and the armed struggle of Mohawk Indians in Canada to prevent the encroachment of commercial and state power on their lands, are only the most recent examples of a long history of violent confrontations between those with status, wealth, and power, and those without it. Repeated peasant uprisings in Europe in the 16th and 17th centuries resulted in the wholesale destruction of crops and buildings and the loss of hundreds of thousands of lives. The deeds of peasant rebels like Pugachev and Zdenko Razin in Eastern Europe live in song and story. It's obviously in the interest of those who have power in society to prevent such violent and destructive conflicts, even if, with the police power of the state, they're sure eventually to win. Repeatedly, as such struggles go on, there are created institutions whose function it is to forestall violent struggle by convincing people that the society in which they live is just and fair, or if it's not just and fair, that it's inevitable and it's quite useless to resort to violence. These are what we call institutions of social legitimation. They're just as much a part of the social struggle as the hayrick burnings and machine destructions of the Captain Swing riots in Britain in the 19th century that helped to populate Australia with their penal colonies. But they use very different weapons. They use ideological weapons. The battleground is now in people's heads, and if the battle is won on that ground, then the peace and tranquility of society are guaranteed. For almost the entire history of European society, since the Empire of Charlemagne, the chief institution of social legitimation was the Christian Church. It was by the grace of God that each person had his or her appointed place in society. Kings ruled Dei gratia. Of course, occasionally divine grace could be conferred on a commoner who was ennobled, and grace could be removed. Grace was removed from King Charles I, as Cromwell noted, and the proof was Charles' severed head. Even the most revolutionary of religious leaders pressed the claims of legitimacy for the sake of order. Martin Luther, that great religious revolutionary, enjoined his flock to obey their lords. And in his famous Sermon on Marriage, he asserted that justice was made for the sake of peace, and not peace for the sake of justice. Peace is the ultimate social good, and justice is important only if it subserves peace. So, women, obey your husbands. Now, for an institution to serve the function of explaining the world so as to make it legitimate, that institution has to possess several features. First, the institution as a whole must appear to derive from sources outside of ordinary human struggle. It must not seem to be the creation of political, economic, or social forces, but it has to descend into society from some superhuman source. Second, the ideas, the pronouncements, the rules, the results of that institution's activity must have a validity and a transcendent truth that goes beyond any possibility of human compromise or human error. Its explanations and pronouncements must seem to be true in an absolute sense, and to derive somehow from some absolute source. They must be true for all time and all place. And finally, the institution must have a certain mystical and veiled quality, so that its innermost operation is not completely transparent to everyone, to the man on the street. It must have an esoteric language which needs to be explained to the ordinary person by those who are especially knowledgeable and who can intervene between everyday life and the mysterious sources of understanding and knowledge. Obviously, the Christian Church, or indeed any revealed religion, fits these requirements perfectly. And so religion has been an ideal institution for legitimating society. But you know, this description also fits science and has made it possible for science to replace religion as the chief legitimating force in modern society. After all, science claims a method that's objective and non-political. It's true for all time. Scientists truly believe that except for the unwanted intrusions of ignorant politicians, science is above the social fray. My teacher, a famous scientist who is a refugee from the Bolshevik Revolution and who detested the Bolsheviks, devoted a lot of energy to pointing out the serious scientific errors that were being made in the Soviet Union in biology and in genetics as a consequence of the unorthodox biological doctrines of T.D. Lysenko. I once pointed out to him that following his own political convictions, he ought not to carry on that campaign against Lysenko. After all, he believed that sooner or later a global conflict would occur with the United States and the Soviet Union on opposite sides, and he also believed that Lysenko's false scientific doctrines were severely weakening Soviet agricultural production. So why did he not then simply remain quiet about Lysenko's errors, so that the Soviet Union would be weakened and compromised in the conflict that was to come? His answer was that his obligation to speak the truth about science was superior to all other obligations, and that a scientist must never allow a political consideration to prevent him from saying what he believes to be true. Not only the methods and institutions of science are said to be above ordinary human relations, but of course the product of science is claimed to be a kind of universal truth. The secrets of nature are unlocked. Once the truth about nature is revealed, then no one can fight it. One must accept the facts of life. When science speaks, let no dog bark. Finally, science speaks in mysterious words. No one except an expert can understand what scientists say and do. And we require the mediation of special people, science journalists, for example, or professors who speak on the radio, to explain the mysteries of science, because otherwise there's nothing but indecipherable formulas. Nor can one scientist understand the formulas of another scientist. Once, when Sir Sally Zuckerman, the famous English zoologist, was asked what he does when he reads a scientific paper and comes across a mathematical formula, he said, "Oh, I hum them." Of course, despite its claims to be above society, science, like the church before it, is a supremely social institution, reflecting the dominant values and views of society at each historical epoch, as well as reinforcing them. Sometimes, the ways in which scientific theories are translated directly from social experience are obvious, even at a detailed level. The most famous case is Darwin's theory of evolution by natural selection. No scientist doubts that the organisms on Earth today have evolved over billions of years from organisms that were very unlike them, and that nearly all types of organisms have long since gone extinct. Moreover, we know this to be a natural process, resulting from the differential survivorship of different forms. In this sense, we all accept Darwinism as being true. But Darwin's explanation for that evolution is a very different matter. He claimed that there was a universal struggle for existence, because more organisms were born than could survive, and that in the course of that struggle for existence, those organisms that were more efficient, better designed, cleverer, and generally better built for the struggle would leave more offspring than the inferior kinds. As a consequence of this victory in the struggle for existence, evolutionary change occurred. But even Darwin himself was conscious of the source of his own ideas about the struggle for existence. He claimed that the idea for evolution by natural selection occurred to him after reading the famous Essay on Population by the Reverend Malthus, a late 18th century economist. That essay was an argument against the old English poor law, which provided welfare payments for the poor in their own homes. The landowners, for whom Malthus was a spokesman, wanted a much tougher law, in which the poor would receive minimal relief and only if they worked at hard labor in parish workhouses. Malthus supported this argument by claiming that all organisms, including human beings, reproduce too rapidly for the growth of their resources. Thus, if the poor were supported too liberally, they would simply reproduce more poor people, who would be a further drain on resources. The only solution was to let starvation take its inevitable and natural toll. Darwin saw in Malthus a universal principle, that all organisms are engaged in the struggle for existence in a world of insufficient resources. Therefore, only those who are more efficient and skillful would survive. By the competition between individuals, acting in their own narrow self-interest, all of evolutionary progress had taken place. This is precisely what Adam Smith argued when he claimed that individual economic competition would act as an invisible hand to make the economy as a whole act efficiently. In this way, Darwin's whole theory of evolution by natural selection bears an uncanny resemblance to the political economic theory of early capitalism. Darwin himself had some personal knowledge of the economic survival of the fittest, because he got his living from investment in railroad shares, which he followed daily in the newspapers. What Darwin did was to take early 19th century political economy and expand it to include all of natural economy. Moreover, he developed a theory of sexual selection and evolution, in which the chief force is the competition among males to be more appealing to discriminating females. This theory is meant to explain why male animals often displayed bright colors or complex mating dances. It's not clear that Darwin was conscious of how similar his view of sexual selection was to the standard 19th century Victorian view of the proper relationship between middle-class males and middle-class females. In reading Darwin's theory, one can see the proper young lady seated on her sofa while the swain on his knees before her begs for her hand, having already told her father how many hundreds a year he has in income. Most of the ideological influence from society that permeates science is a great deal more subtle than this. It comes in the form of basic assumptions, of which scientists themselves are usually not aware. Yet those assumptions have a profound effect on the forms of their explanations, and in turn serve to reinforce social attitudes that gave rise to those explanations in the first place. One important example is the way scientists have interpreted the relation of individuals to collectivities, the famous problem of parts and wholes. Before the 18th century, European society placed little or no emphasis on the importance of the individual. On the contrary, the activity of people was determined by the social class into which they were born, except in very exceptional cases, and individual people confronted each other as representatives of their social groups. In a dispute, for example, between a priest and a merchant over some commercial matter, the priest would make his case in an ecclesiastical court before his bishop, and the merchant in the court of his own lord, rather than both being subject to the same uniform judgment. Individuals were not seen as the causes of social arrangements, but as their consequence. Moreover, people were not free to move in the economic hierarchy. Peasants and lords alike had mutual obligations and were bound to each other by those obligations. There were no freely moving competitive labor forces where each person had the power to sell his or her own labor power in the labor market.